Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuc. Each weekday morning, Roundtable host Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from these conversations, focusing on some important news items from the week. On Wednesday, July 9th, Joe was joined by Professor of History and International Relations at Vassar College, Robert Brigham, Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, and CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan.
We'll begin with the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court clearing the way for mass firings at federal agencies. The Trump administration can move forward with plans to slash the federal workforce and dismantle federal agencies. That was an announcement made by the court on Tuesday. The decision could result in job losses for tens of thousands of employees at agencies, including the Department of Housing and Urban Development, State, and Treasury. The order, which listed a lower court's ruling that had blocked mass layoffs, was unsigned and did not include a vote count. That is typical in such emergency applications, although Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson did write a public dissent. The case represents a key test of the extent of President Trump's power to reorganize the government without input from Congress. The justice's order is technically only temporary, guiding how the administration can proceed while the challenge to Mr. Trump's plans continue. But in practice, it means he is free to pursue his restructuring plans, even if judges down the road determine that they exceed presidential power. That from the New York Times, and we check in now with our group. What do you think, Robert?
Well, I think there's a lot to unpack here, Joe. First of all, I think the court was following precedent in a sense in that they really didn't want to have a position where a president must have explicit statutory authorization from Congress on personnel decisions in the executive branch. That has been consistent with the way that this court has been thinking. There will be lawsuits. This will go forward, no doubt. And there will be lawsuits from a variety of quarters on this overturning of that Northern District of California court that had temporarily paused it. I think we're going to see some more action like this. To me, what's really interesting and tragic about this is that unlike the Big Beautiful Bill, which in a way, you know, scoots most of those painful cuts to after the 2026 election, this can be implemented today. And I think we're going to see pushback from not only the unions involved and not only political action committees involved, but I also think that there's going to be some knock-on effect that this administration hasn't thought about. 29% of this federal workforce of 2 million people are veterans. 11% of all veterans work for the federal government. That's equal to all the number of people in the United States who have manufacturing jobs. So when you start talking about powerful groups like veterans that are going to be caught up in these cuts, I think that the administration is going to be surprised by the pushback it's going to get from quarters that usually don't push back.
And the pushback, I'm interested in the fact that they didn't anticipate the pushback because you think they would.
I don't think this administration thinks second or third order principles at all.
Yeah, okay, I understand that. All right, Bob.
I actually believe the court was correct in the decision, in part, and this is an important nuance. The way I interpreted the decision is that because there wasn't actual harm, that the executive orders were more about direction to plan for, court said, we're going to wait until there's actual harm. This is also, though, where I thought Brown Jackson's dissent was also correct, saying, you know, wait a second, is that if you're going to wait for the house to have burnt down, then that's a really silly thing to do, and you overstepped, you stepped on the toes of the lower courts. So I actually sort of agree that both elements of both the dissent and the ultimate majority decision, which again, it was a two-paragraph decision. This isn't a full case.
Right.
So I think that's important.
Which is typical in emergency decisions.
Yeah. But let's talk about a couple of things that that this does. And I thought Robert's comments about the veterans in the workforce was really important. I'll also note that the continued cuts to the federal workforce mask an exponentially larger number of cuts to contractors. The ripple effect of the changes to the federal government, I think, are and continue to be or will continue to intensify as a drag on the overall economy. And it's interesting looking at some of the economic numbers. I don't see a rosy economy. I'm even more pessimistic about the economy than I have been. And this is still without the Taco Tuesday tariffs situation really, really kicking in. The other part of the conversations that we should be having is, again, what's not going to get done? And part of the reason your question, I thought, Joe, was spot on about, well, you know, didn't they think there's going to be pushback? Yeah, they think there's going to be pushback. They don't care.
Right.
And part of what they're doing by basically dismantling the federal bureaucracy is that they're wiping out decades and decades and decades of experience with the idea that in order to rebuild the type of experience that the federal government has had, it will take multiple generations. So the idea that anybody is going to be able to come back and put Humpty Dumpty back together again is going to be false. And this is all part of Project 2025, that by being able to break the expertise of the federal bureaucracy, you achieve a couple things. One is that nobody's going to be able to tell you no. They can claim that they're dealing with this fictional deep state power base. And they're going to then be able to pick and choose what is going to be implemented even when Congress approves it and it's signed into law. There's simply not going to be enough people to do the job. FEMA already has lost more than a quarter of its workforce. That quarter isn't even articulating those that are out on injury, those that are out on leave. I mean, so you're, all of a sudden you're starting to think about a workforce that is down or been cut by maybe 30%, maybe 40%. And then everybody's going to question why an agency can't do the job they're doing. Think about your own workforce if you suddenly were reduced that way. And this is going to be a ripple effect that we're going to see through so many other agencies.
I think Bob's absolutely right here. And the lost part of this is the capacity of the federal government. I mean, these things, these systems and capacities aren't built overnight. I mean, FDR had to go through the Great Hurricane of 1938 to understand the kind of mobilization of what parts of the federal government needed to be. That paved the way for the mobilization, ultimately, actually, for the 300,000 people that are going to go into the Navy. You can't build that kind of capacity, knowledge, or systems overnight. And to dismantle in this quick a way is haphazard at best.
Heather Mulligan joins us, CEO of the Business Council of New York State. Good morning. How are you?
I'm well.
What do you think?
So a couple things. First, I do not agree. And so I've learned, like, I have to make sure that people understand when I'm saying something that it doesn't mean I agree with the underlying decision to get rid of a lot of federal employees. I do agree that that will have a long-term impact on an impact on the willingness of people to join the federal government. And of course, there are, you know, certainly people who are very talented who are lost. That being said, the Supreme Court is correct in their decision. This is the executive branch. The executive has broad authority over personnel in the executive branch. And back, I don't know, God, I don't even know how long ago it was, when the Pataki administration took over New York government from the Mario Cuomo administration, this actual circumstance was tested at our own state court of appeals. And the finding there was that the executive has broad authority to shrink, eliminate, get rid of people who have been there, who considered themselves lifers. If they don't have civil service protection, And they were people who were hired for policymaking decisions for someone of a previous administration. There's no obligation on the part of the executive to retain them. That the protections of civil service, which I'm sure would certainly apply to many of the people who were let go of the federal government, can only be gotten around by doing broad shrinkage of agencies overall rather than – so, you know, saying we're going to cut workforce by 10% for economic reasons, they can't be singled out because of their political views or anything like that. But people who are in policymaking positions certainly can. So I don't think the Supreme Court's wrong. I think that's why there's only one dissenter, and I think they're correct. I just want to make it clear that doesn't mean that I agree with what has been done here. I also just caution people to use specific examples of you know, terrible events to try and find a reason and pin the blame on something when it's very likely that this flood would have been equally as tragic had there not been layoffs at you know, federal agencies. I'm not saying that's 100% certain, but to try and connect those dots retroactively, I think is a little dangerous because that makes us look away from other things that need to be corrected as well. So I guess that's what I have to say about that in the words of Forrest Gump.
but there's the issue of the actual employees and how they're affected and
oh,
the
yeah.
way in which this was done, right?
Yeah. But, you know, Heather, I'll push back respectfully and say that you don't have to be a brain surgeon to say if you're going to reduce an agency's workforce, you know, overnight by 30% or 40%, that there's going to be a degradation of service, right?
Yeah, I mean that's definitely true. But if there were at 100%, does that mean that the outcome would have been different? And I don't know that we can say that.
I think you could make compelling cases that if you have 100% staffing, which no agency ever does, that their capacity to do their job is better. Now, yeah. is there
but
you know, again,
their
this
job
gets
wasn't
me,
to do the warning here. I mean,
I'm sorry?
It wasn't their job to do the warning. I mean, the system, the state itself decided not to implement.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so.
And this is a conversation that we could have, I mean, again, further when we're talking about the flood, but you're hitting, I think, a really interesting question about what's the role of government and what is the role of the federal government? The definition of what government is and should be is being redefined before us by a series of executive orders without congressional input, without a public understanding of the impact on services or any of those debates. And I think that's the pushback that I appreciated in the Brown-Jackson dissent. And again, I think the Sotomayor's position, which she was spot on, that you have to wait for the plans to be implemented before you can claim damages. So the court made the right decision, but I thought Brown-Jackson was apropos in her concerns.
And that is why I premised what I said by saying I don't necessarily agree with what was done. I do believe that the decision is correct, that this is within the realm of executive authority, and it is not controlled by congressional authority as to the ability to control the employees or to limit or get rid of employees in the executive branch. And I would suggest that on principle, you know, if you have a next presidential administration that is a Democrat, you certainly would want them to not have to rely on congressional authority to get rid of some of the folks that their predecessor had put in place, say, at Department of State or Department of Justice. So it's sort of like where you sit depends on your view of this. And I try and step back and say, underlying principle here, is the Supreme Court correct? And I believe that they are. I am again saying, and I'll just for further clarification, not saying that I agree with the actions that were taken by the administration, just that I believe the Supreme Court is correct in saying that the executive does not have to seek congressional approval to eliminate positions in the federal government. Now, some of those positions, he may need congressional approval because even in state government, in many governments, you need congressional authority to put people in place. That doesn't mean you need it to get rid of them, but there are circumstances where positions are protected and there is legislative oversight. But that's not the vast majority of positions.
And only Congress can get rid of a department. So if there's a larger goal here, it's going to run up against that guardrail.
Right.
Right now, at least, only Congress can get rid of a department.
And but I mean, this is where the courts need to sort of help define is that if it's a shell, if they're unable to fulfill the obligation, I mean, you can hollow out a department to the point where it's completely inefficient. And, you know, it's interesting, Heather, you raised two very important points. One is, I hope any aspiring Democratic presidential candidate is watching very carefully at how presidential power appears to be shifted. And sometimes I don't think that the Democrats play hardball as well when they have the levers of power. And so I think what's good for Trump and the Trump administration, whatever comes next, hopefully it will be a regime change, needs to be in place. I also would say that sort of as a student of government, I still think it's a bad practice for the country to move away from a civil service that's protected from partisanship. The idea that the civil service should be answering to whatever administration and administration sets policy, the civil service helps implement it. That's the way I always understood it when I was in my career roles in the federal government. And we're going back, whether we like it or not, to more of a Jacksonian spoil system where the executive comes in, brings in all of its friends, which means that when the administration goes out, all of the friends are going to get either dug out or wiped out or asked to leave, which means that government isn't going to be more efficient that way. But again, this is a sort of a more theoretical conversation about how the federal government should operate.
Bob Griffin on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, July 9th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this. Back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, July 10th, Joe Donahue was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, former vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association Judy Patrick, professor of government at Dutchess Community College, and the president of the World Affairs Council of the Mid-Hudson Valley, Dr. Karen Riedel.
The administration has decided to take steps to target two officials who investigated Donald Trump. And it's unclear whether moves targeting the former FBI director James Comey and the former CIA director John Brennan will lead to charges, but they appear to be targeting officials who oversaw the investigation of the 2016 Trump campaign connection to Russia. Examining the actions of Comey and Brennan, John Ratcliffe, the CIA director and a harsh critic of his Democratic-appointed predecessors, has made a criminal referral of Brennan to the FBI, accusing him of lying to Congress. The Bureau is also scrutinizing Mr. Comey for his role in the Russia investigation, other officials said, although the exact basis for any inquiry remains unclear. Even if it is unclear whether the moves will lead to charges, they are among the most significant indications that President Trump's appointees intend to follow through in his campaign to exact retribution against his perceived enemies. But didn't we already know that? I mean, didn't we know that through Columbia? Didn't we know that through Harvard? Didn't we know that through the investigation into Joe Biden and his cognitive awareness? This is not new, is it, Judy?
You know, I think we're just so naive that we thought, no, that couldn't be true. They couldn't possibly do that. That is so wrong that he wouldn't dare do it. But in the time, it's like losing the football. You know, he got us again. Yeah, he's going to do it. I mean, I think it serves two purposes. It's just to hassle these guys, make them pay for lawyers, make them, you know, agonize, because it's never pleasant to be, you know, hauled in to be investigated. The other thing is to keep this notion alive that Russia wasn't in favor of him in the 2016 election. I mean, we keep forgetting that, whether or not there was any collusion between the campaign and Russian officials, you know, that's still debatable. But, I mean, certainly Russia wanted Donald Trump to win, and it was clear from, you know, all of the investigations. So he's just trying to hassle him. This is just the start. We're only in the first year of his term, only like 5 or 6 months. I mean, it's going to get worse and worse for those people. And what it does is put a really strong damper on anybody speaking out against him going forward, because you're worried about it. It's not pleasant to be investigated by the FBI. Hopefully they'll just dismiss this as baseless.
But also, yes, it certainly dampens that. But it also takes our eyes away from what else is going on. Right, Teresa?
Well, that's exactly right. When I saw this story, I thought, okay, what is he trying to distract our attention from? Is it his failure on tariffs? Because remember, 90 deals in 90 days. 90 days is up, and there is not a single formal deal. There's one that's, outline of a deal. So is it the failure to broker a ceasefire in Gaza? Remember, Netanyahu's here, but he came to the United States, and normally there would have been some, you would have thought there'd be something announced if he's going to come for a visit. Not one but two meetings, no announcements except for that there are no deals, that there's no deals to get the hostages out, there's no resolution to the horrific situation, the humanitarian situation there in terms of the Palestinians getting access to food, and no ceasefire. Is he trying to draw attention away from the federal response to the flooding in Texas and his plan to eliminate FEMA, you know, send it back to the states? It should be their responsibility. Well, you see something like this and you know why. Or what about the cuts in the National Weather Service? Trying to draw attention away from the rescissions bill. As people learn more and more about what's in it, it becomes more and more concerning. There's a long list. Distract from the Epstein files. You know, a number of people say, well, you know, maybe he's trying to draw attention away because the MAGA crowd is really distraught about what's going on with the Epstein files. Or maybe about the Ukraine. I mean, the list goes on and on. But the thing that worries me so much is, and I think that more attention needs to be paid to this because it's becoming normalized, the just blatant politicization, if I could say that word properly, of the Justice Department. The fact that it's happened so deeply and so swiftly is really, really troubling. And I hope if any listeners here, lawyers who can maybe talk about this, but I think that we need to be very, very worried about the swift and complete shift from the Justice Department being essentially an independent entity to being part of his, both literally and figuratively, his law enforcement, his legal team. right? Because a lot of people who were a personal legal team now have shifted over. And these same people who were being paid to defend him, you know, in personal legal issues, are now being paid by taxpayers' dollars to try to address these issues and rewrite the history about Russia's interference. And shouldn't the President of the United States and the FBI be concerned about Russian interference, which no doubt is still going on? And on the same day, and I'm going on too much, but on the same day, the same week that he's saying how upset he is with Putin, he continues to dismiss the notion that Russia is interfering in our country, whether it's in our elections or our day-to-day business. This is a serious problem, a whole series of serious problems.
Karen?
Oh, I have to let all of this.
She's like, Carrie, she finally died.
Sorry.
I'm fired up about this, surprising,
right? It was very clear during Trump's campaign that this is what he was going to do. So it is not surprising. What is surprising, and maybe not surprising, but it keeps shocking me that there is no one within the administration to push back, to help vent whether this is a move that is desirable for the administration or for the country. This is driven by John Ratcliffe the CIA director, who has moved forward the cases and asked the FBI to investigate Mr. Brennan and Mr. Comey. There seems to be everything you listed there, all these concerns that we have. There doesn't seem to be anyone in the administration who ever asks the administration to pause and consider the implications of the actions that they're undertaking.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but that has amazed me about this, about the Trump administration since well before 2016 when he was elected. That all of the conventional, and it's worked for him, certainly not the case, but all the conventional ideas that you have of, oh, we're gonna bet something before we say it. We're going to make sure we have our facts straight before we say it. If we put this number out, it's gonna be the best number that we can come up with. And what we have found out over the last 10 years is, yeah, that doesn't matter.
But how far do they bend the rules before they break these departments, right? I mean, what's it going to take?
I mean, I don't mean to be the cynical jerk, but haven't they already broken these departments?
There was a person interviewed last night. I won't get his name right, but he has resigned, basically pushed out of the Justice Department. And he wasn't one of the top echelon people. And he wrote a piece in the paper basically saying, pay attention. There's a really, what's going on in the Justice Department is deeply troubling. And he was asked, well, why did you do it? He said, well, because I was asked to. Well, who were you asked by? He said, a lot of people within the Justice Department, not the top political appointees, but the line prosecutors, the line investigators. He said that they feel like the top people left, abandoning them, and didn't go out and speak about what's happening inside to try to stop some of it, and that maybe he could or should. But I think there, you know, this alarm needs to be sounded about the misuse of these agencies in the quest for Trump's personal, you know, vindictive effort. And these are costly. The costly in dollars, this thing has been studied to death. Right? There's nothing new that's going to come out of this. It's been studied by a special prosecutor. It's been researched. They've been hearing after hearing after hearing, all with a heavy price tag. But also, what's the cost of shifting the focus of the department? Because everybody who's working on this is not working on something else. Right? It's like shifting a lot of the resources toward deportation of people, right? Everybody, it's just a misplaced use of resources, and it's degrading the institutions by politicizing them.
It is interesting to me that if you think that, and maybe this is just naive on my part, but that if you're somebody like James Comey, who, you know, I think we all have our thoughts on James Comey, and maybe not all good thoughts about James Comey. But you do think that once you've left and you know you're out writing mystery novels, and you know you're out on the boat, that none of this is going to come back, meaning that you're done. You've served your time. You're done.
You're free and clear.
And then you're not.
You got to wonder. So all the things that are happening in these first two years of the Trump administration, if the Democrats, you know, win the House or win the Senate in midterms, what kind of investigations are they going to do? And are they going to be, you know, described as political or witch hunts? And when they might be very legitimate investigations, it is so hard to, you know, in this muddle that we're in the political world, what's going to happen going forward. But clearly, this is, he said it was retribution. And we as a country, I didn't think, believed in retribution. I often wonder how on top of things Donald Trump himself is, or whether or not he gave marching orders a long time ago. He seems like he's not a detail-oriented guy. You know, when you ask him a specific question like, who authorized the suspension of arms shipment to Ukraine? I don't really know. You know, the things he doesn't know amaze me still. So how intimately he's involved with this, or whether his lieutenants are doing this, is a question for me.
But that is one of the main concerns, and that's what I was trying to say earlier. He may not be giving the marching orders anymore, but he has followers in the administration, and they are seeing through what he wants.
Or what he thinks they want.
Right.
Well, I think the issue on the Ukraine authorization is who really did that, because did Hegseth even know? And there's a person below Hegseth who has an agenda, and which, you know, had been the Project 2025 agenda, which they want to shift the focus to China. And certainly this administration, though they said they were going to shift the focus to China, the focus has really been on the Middle East, on the one side, on the business deal side, because of Trump's own interest in his own business deals. Remember going to Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Qatar, right, and making all those deals, as many deals for his family as he did for the country, and some of that he did for the country. We have concerns about, because of, this gets into too much detail, but chip technology, and is he giving away some key chip technology in some of those deals? But more importantly, what's going on in Gaza with the Palestinians, what's going on in Israel, what's going on, you know, the bombing in Iran. You know, it's really just mired in the Middle East when they believe that the focus should be on China. And so did Hegseth even know that decision was made? If he did, why didn't he tell the president? If he didn't, how come he didn't know? And then the president, I thought, was interesting. He said he didn't know. And then a few moments later, he said, well, if a decision like that was made, I'd be the one to make it, and I would know. Now, if President Obama had said that, or Biden had said that, or even Bush, there'd be days of headlines saying, what's wrong with him, right? Because it was totally nonsensical. But what happens, you know, it gets sane-washed by the media. And then, oh, this is just his way of negotiating. It's what's going on. And just remember, if the Justice Department is going to open up an investigation, a criminal investigation, traditionally, it's not discussed. It's not discussed until they're prepared to bring charges.
Well, that takes away all the fun.
Remember all the outrage with Comey, right, when he said he's going to investigate Hillary Clinton just before the election, when you don't do that?
Well, rightfully so, right?
Rightfully that he was going to investigate her, or rightfully that there was that outrage about him
that
saying
that?
That
there was outrage.
Yes, right, because that was norm-breaking. You don't do that and then say, well, we're going to have charges, but she's on investigation. Was he just appealing to his MAGA base? Because these guys, you know, the MAGA base really wants to go after these guys. I don't know. But it's not the right way to use the government.
Let's go to a letter from a listener whose name is Peter. Understand, nobody in the Trump administration is doing anything for the good of our country. They are a collection of grifters, sociopaths, and pathological liars. They are in their positions to get rich and to exercise power. Nothing they do should surprise you.
I
I think we're speechless because it does seem to be that way, even though, you know, you want to believe otherwise. You know, I was listening to Tom Tillis today, you know, talking on CNN about how, well, you know, maybe Hegseth wasn't up for the job. But, you know, he only voted to confirm him based on what he knew at the time. Well, guess what? Most of us knew at the time he wasn't fit to be Secretary of Defense.
Well, that was a fascinating interview with Jake Tapper because he was saying, well, you know, we knew he had problems with alcohol. We knew he had problems with he couldn't keep down a job. We knew that his record was very spotty. We didn't know this, but there was a lot of pressure put on us, and everybody said it was going to be okay. So I said, oh, okay. And then, but I knew he wasn't good for the job. And he said the same thing about RFK Jr.
Right. And talking about one of the charges they're trying to bring against Comey and Brennan is lying to Congress. Well, what about RFK telling Congress that he was, you know, he's not a vaccine denier? When he is a vaccine denier, let's be clear about that. The Tillis remarks. You know what? If you're going to admit blame, concede it. Say you screwed up and you shouldn't have. But no, he had to say, no, what I voted with what the information I had at the time. Well, you know, read the newspapers, watch the news.
You had enough. They had enough information at the time. And I'm glad you brought up RFK Jr. because the news out yesterday, which the U.S. has hit a new record. Right?
Of measles?
Number of measles. Largest, you know, record of measles in 30 years. Congratulations, new record. 30, as she said cynically, 30 years. And what is going on? And now with this Supreme Court giving the green light to lay off all these people, there'll be further deep cuts within layoffs within HHS, Health and Human Services. And it's only going to get worse. And, you know, you have the same nonsense on vaccination as you do with going on in the FBI. And what does that do to line prosecutors? What is the day-to-day like for them? What kinds of pressures are they under to do things that they know aren't right, right? That they know aren't the norm. Focus on things that aren't the priorities, but are Trump's personal priorities.
In regard to Tillis' comments on Hegseth, and his regret for voting for him and for Kennedy, I find it extraordinarily spineless to do this at this point after he decided not to run again. Only after it was made clear to him that Trump would support a more MAGA-oriented candidate. And this is the situation we find ourselves in, that only once they decide not to run, and only decide not to run when they know they stand no chance, or they will face serious challenges because of the pressure put on them by the administration, that is when they speak out.
Karen Riedel on the Roundtable Panel on Thursday, July 10th. We'll be back with the final segment of the Roundtable Panel of the Week in Review after this. Welcome to the final segment of this morning's Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, July 11th, the Roundtable panelists were Joseph Powell Mountain Chair in Government at Skidmore College, Beau Breslin, Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia Dumont, and semi-retired editor-at-large columnist and editorial writer for the Times Union, Jay Jochnowitz.
Let's talk about FEMA, let's talk about Texas, and let's talk about the deployment. Obviously, the story in Texas becomes more and more grim as time goes on, as the numbers start to rise and the president is expected to be going to Texas. And now folks are starting to look at the rescue efforts that that took place. And certainly FEMA officials are saying that the search and rescue efforts in the Texas floods were slowed by budget rules. And these are budget rules imposed by Kristi Noem. So 2 days before the torrential rains turned the Guadalupe River into a raging flood, a veteran official with the Federal Management Federal Emergency Management Agency told the Washington Post that one of the main concerns for this disaster season was the agency's ability to quickly deploy specialized search and rescue teams. The Trump administration's new rules mean disaster specialists can no longer make decisions on their own. The official then watched it happen in real time in Texas. Deployments of critical resources such as tactical and specialized search and rescue teams were delayed as a result of a budget restriction requiring Homeland Security Kristi Noem to approve every purchase, every contract, every grant over $100,000, according to dozens of current and former FEMA employees who spoke on the condition of anonymity, because they were not authorized to speak with the media. When rapidly responding to a billion-dollar disaster, that is basically everything, said one current official, meaning everything's going to be over $100,000. Other efforts by the administration to constrain spending have hampered FEMA's operations, officials said, which is likely to make it harder for the agency to be proactive during what is predicted to be a busy disaster season. Jay.
You know, it's been almost a trope for years for Donald Trump, and anytime there's a Democratic administration in Washington, the Republican Party, that FEMA can't do its job, that whoever, fill in the name of the president, doesn't know how to run FEMA. And now, you know, this is a test. And not doing so well. You know, I heard some early reports about this. There were also, you know, people were talking about the prediction problems of this storm. And I think the Washington Post or the New York Times did a story very early on that that the way this storm kind of unfolded would have been very hard to predict. Originally, the forecast was, you know, nice. And then it was drizzle. And then it was going to rain. And then it was, oh, my God, get to the high ground. At 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, so I that's been in my mind ever since I've been following this, because you don't want to do the cliche stuff of just, you know, let's blame whoever we want to blame, because that's what we want to do. We want to blame only the people we want to blame. We don't want to blame the people we don't. But in this case, it seems that the administration and, you know, so Trump is kind of distanced from this because it's Kristi Noem and Kristi Noem's doing her own thing. But, you know, this is a person who seems to be very scattered in her approach to the job. You know, she's out there, you know, modeling the latest, SWAT fashion at, you know, whatever event she, you know, she's showing up for. And she's now, I mean, if this story is, they didn't get into the details of how she is doing this, but is she sitting down with her phone or is she sitting down at a desk and actually looking at every piece of paper that says more than $100,000 on it and every contract? That's crazy. This is not how any executive. She was the governor of South Dakota. I can't imagine she did this as the governor of South Dakota.
The second word in that title is emergency.
Yeah.
And an emergency would tend to indicate that things need to move pretty fast to
Ms. Noem needs to look at the contract
the
first.
Emergency.
Holy.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Well, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It is interesting. And also, you know, what exactly then how much of what we're seeing is what we would refer to prior to this Trump administration, a quote unquote normal FEMA response.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think we're learning that as well. Bill Breslin.
Yeah. So, Joe, first of all, let me just say, let me just acknowledge what must be unimaginable pain for those folks who are going through it. I got a 26-year-old daughter. I can't imagine what it must be like for the parents of those Camp Mystic kids. That said, I'm going to be a little callous here, but and talk about the politics of disaster relief, right? So let's think about it. You need, in order for FEMA to kick in, you need a presidential declaration. Both Democrats and Republicans are quick with that because there's benefit to being quick with declaration. But I did a quick and dirty survey. 85% of the FEMA was founded in 1979, officially by the Carter administration. 85% of the declarations that FEMA has attended to have happened in red states, right? So it's mostly hurricanes. When it's blue states, it's typically wildfires in California or so on. 9/11 was one that FEMA obviously responded to. And so there is politics involved in FEMA. I will say Trump is a master, Jay, this is what I think you're getting at. Trump is a master of shaping the narrative, right? So my daughter, my 26-year-old daughter's best friend works for FEMA out of New York. And she was deployed last year as a result of hurricanes. And she was met by folks in Georgia and Florida and so on with resistance. I heard the NPR story this morning that a lot of people in Texas are thrilled with FEMA at the moment. That's partly because Trump is a master of shaping the narrative. Mm-hmm. He comes out in the campaign and he says, we're going to either eliminate or reduce FEMA. Play right out of Project 2025, right, which is all about giving states more power over FEMA. And then if you're on the ground, any relief in an environment in which Trump has said we're going to reduce it, any relief that you get on the ground is seen as positive. So he actually did what is a strategically political move by saying we're going to make FEMA less important in as a federal resource, and then all of a sudden people are on the ground are delighted. When my daughter's best friend said FEMA under the Biden administration was a disaster, so his playbook is the Trump playbook of blaming and criticizing is part of the equation here. I'll say two more quick things. One is FEMA is representative of, in some ways, the way in which Democrats appear weak. So Trump comes in and the Republicans come in and they talk about fixing the problem. People are pleased in Texas about the way in which FEMA has responded. And Democrats with the sort of a liberal progressive agenda that Republicans describe as woke are seen as empathetic and weak, not strong. That's partly the Democrats have to figure out a response to that. And then the last thing I'll say is the article, Joe, there was a new article in The Washington Post that just came out in which we're not talking about abolishing FEMA anymore. We're talking about revamping it. This is a quote from that Washington Post article. Federal resources are intended to supplement state action, says the Trump administration. So it's about giving money back to the states. I'd love to have a conversation down the road about how all these institutions, from the Supreme Court to the president to Congress, are now trying to deflect things down to the state level and how that has real implications for protection of individual rights and so on.
You know, and also going into this red state, blue state divide as to who gets the upper hand, and we were seeing these reports of while the money, and even with this delay, money being delivered to Texas much faster than to the people of California,
correct,
who are suffering from the fires that, yeah, that ravaged that state and the city of Los Angeles. Malia.
Yeah, as someone who used to work in federal government, I want to echo Jay's comments about this is not how you can run any kind of institution, especially one, as you said, Joe, that has the word emergency in the title of it. When I was in the Pentagon for my first couple years there, I worked in the Office of Homeland Defense Policy, which our job was to coordinate with FEMA to make sure that Department of Defense assets were organized in such a way that they could support FEMA-led efforts. So I'm intimately familiar with all the work that goes on behind the scenes, the immense amount of preparation that it takes for a disaster that you hope never happens, but when it does, you have to have done all that preparation work in advance. What Kristi Noem has done is so performative. This $100,000, it's so patently preposterous that would be the dollar level that she would randomly choose, because nothing's going to be below that. And it's also, it's infantilizing for all of her colleagues to assume like this entire institution, even if you think, okay, there's some bloat and waste, and maybe we can cut some positions from within FEMA, but still to concentrate all that decision making with her. What are these people down like within the rest of the structure doing? They're not allowed to have any thoughts of their own, and this is the way Trump wants a cabinet secretary to be spending her time, is which I assume she's not, actually, because I can't imagine that she is just tied to a desk and reviewing stacks and stacks and stacks of paperwork, looking at the details of every $100,000 plus expenditure. So it's preposterous.
But is that a power move on her part?
I think it's it's a performative move. She likes it's something she can say, like, we're rooting out corruption, whether she is or not. She's actually causing more waste, fraud, and abuse by having this choke point with her. Is it a power move? I don't know what it gives her that she didn't already have, other than a lot more time in a chair reviewing paperwork.
Yeah, I mean, it's oversight, and you're going to always have the oversight.
Right.
I mean, all of us, I think, have worked at offices where they've said, you know, you got $100, $150, and if you're getting it, you know, and if you're going to get just the normal file cabinet, go order the file cabinet, give us a purchase order. If you're going to get the really good file cabinet, there's going to be a lot of money. We want to oversee that. Like, all that makes sense to me. But this is obviously much different, again, because of the emergency nature.
I think it's made for sound bites. Like, that's all it was made for.
Yeah, and I also think that I think Malia's right about the fact that the $100,000, which is a ridiculously low amount for FEMA or, quite frankly, for any federal agency, is a random number. And the principle or the strategy of we're going to root out all waste and fraud and have a number in the $100,000 range in order to do that. It's her way of sort of getting into the game, right? It's an Elon Musk moment where Elon Musk uses firing federal officials as his way to root out waste and fraud. Her thing is she's going to approve every $100,000. I just think it's part of this whole messaging and strategic approach to politics in the 21st century.
This is what I think is happening inside FEMA right now, because she is busy out modeling the latest in SWAT fashions, as you point out. She's not doing this. So instead, she has an aide. She is an aide who is doing this for her.
Yeah. Yes.
An aide that we don't know who that person is, who is making these recommendations. And that unknown person, who is probably pretty junior and some handpicked acolyte of hers, is making these recommendations to her and saying, this all looks good. Now you can sign off on it. And nobody understands from the outside, and I'm sure not in Congress, they're not paying attention. They have the oversight responsibility, but they don't know how this is happening. But I think that is the truth of the matter, that this aide, or maybe it's two or three of them, are that in secret making these decisions, and then she just signs off on it. And then the other thing that's happening is everyone below her office, many of whom are longstanding, nonpartisan federal employees, they're going to have to figure out some way around this, right? Because they can't do their jobs with this system in place. So I don't know what kind of scrambling they might be doing, but it encourages sort of like people to act outside the normal way of doing things, which is also not good for oversight and efficiency and all the things that that we want out of our government agencies.
The reporting did say that they are doing some internal workarounds to deal with this. They didn't quite. It was a little hard to understand exactly what the workarounds were, but it did refer to that. So you know, it's an agency that's gonna function in spite of her. But I also think. And I'll be real quick about this.
No, go ahead. Like, no,
that the reading the story, it was sometimes hard to separate. You know, whether they were talking about the federal government or the state government, because Texas's Department of Emergency, whatever their title is, has a big role here, and it sounds like they have some real problems with what they've done in terms of, you know, one of the things that was talked about. I wasn't sure if it was this story or another one that said that it was a different story we read that. That they had denied two or three requests for an alarm system for this very type of
the latest situation. This spring. I mean there have been calls for this type of system to be put in place for years. The latest call being just a few months ago. Mm-hmm. Which is really interesting.
So that's probably going to be Trump's. They should have been raking the forest.
And Jay, your point is not insignificant because the struggles that Texas is having as a state on the ground are going to just be exacerbated in Louisiana and Arkansas and states that don't have the capacity. Mm-hmm. Texas has the capacity to be able to work the system better than the states around it. And so if you keep pushing the states, the responsibility down to the states, some are going to be able to do a relatively decent job, Texas and New York. Others, Arkansas and Kansas, not so much.
Like on all of these things that we talk about as far as cuts that are being made to the government, which why wouldn't you think, given the amount of situations, just common sense, that the situations that we have had that as we see these real emergencies upon us, whether it be in Texas or in California or in Florida or hurricanes and throughout the country, the way to counter this is by cutting funds to those agencies and not think that it's going to come back and bite you. And that's I just don't get that part of it, especially, I would add, and this is where perhaps there is some commentary wrapped up in it as well, especially when it doesn't seem to have been done with any great thought. It was just numbers as opposed to, oh, well, this person does that. And we should keep them. And this person does that. And maybe we don't need that. That doesn't seem to be the case. They just went in and said, we got to get rid of 1,000 people. We're going to get rid of 1,000 people. And then they're done. And then something like this happens. And you're like, oh, well, now what do we do?
I think it's part of a big overarching narrative. And it's one of those things that I actually think is one of those fair discussions to have in politics and governance and all that as to what the role of the federal government is. And how big you want your federal bureaucracy to be. If you want a federal bureaucracy that's deeply involved in something like emergency preparedness, emergency disasters, if you want a federal government that's deeply or moderately involved in education, you create an education department, you create a federal emergency management agency, you do these things. And then you can make an argument for that because you could say, look, the federal government has resources, defense resources, for example, that you can draw on that the states just don't have access to. Or you have another theory of it that the states need this, but they can't print money. That's the one thing they can't do. So why don't we give them the money to run their schools? Why don't we give them the money to run their emergency management operations? Why don't we give them the money to do their highways even? Mm-hmm. And on and on and on and on. So it's a fair discussion to have, but I think the operative point here, first of all, I think it's wrong. I think the federal government does have better resources for an emergency like this and greater resources that states shouldn't just be keeping on hand, although they may have to as climate change gets worse.
Jay Jochnowitz on the Roundtable panel yesterday morning. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.